when these issues are brought up in a public arena. These concepts have been discussed often in recent years and months in various arenas. The very fact that these issues are mentioned continually in any forum is evidence that these issues must be resolved. Two, interlocking directorships may be useful in larger non-native corporations where the possibilities for recruiting potential board members are limitless. However, our native corporations are unique in that what we must recruit from within to fill our boards. Does this mean that we are limited in selecting from talent that is available? Three, 1991 is an issue which has been raised all across Alaska at the village, the urban, and the regional levels. My concern is where we as corporations will be as of December 18, 1991, and if our land will be properly managed by that time. I ask, what is my corporation doing to ensure that my interests are being safeguarded and my assets are being handled responsibly? Four, another issue which has been raised is how are the corporations providing for the children born after December 18, 1971? Corporations have first right of refusal regarding stock. If purchased by the corporations, will stocks be distributed among those children who are not benefiting directly as shareholders? Discussion. Taking each issue raised above, what follows are my thoughts and those expressed by others at meetings which I have attended. One, conflict of interest and nepotism. In my definition, conflict of interest occurs when a board member of a corporation, one, serves in a management or board capacity in another corporation, or two, would benefit economically in a business relationship with the corporation. Nepotism occurs when a person directly related to a manager or board member serves the corporation or organization and is compensated for that service. If either issue has been discussed by boards of directors in closed meetings, it seems to me that the logical next step would be to eliminate them altogether. They should be provided for in the corporate bylaws, specifically stating where we stand as a corporation on both issues. Neither issue should have to be raised in the public forum. I, as a shareholder, do not care what the state requires legally on the issues. I care what we, as Native organizations, require of our elected boards. We must avoid even the appearance of conflict of interest and nepotism because the first responsibility we have in the world of business is to our tribe, not just our business associates, nor our children, our siblings, or our family alone. The integrity of our boards must be above reproach. The boards know where their shareholders stand on both issues. If there is discussion on either subject, it is a given that the issue will be raised in a public forum. Two, interlocking directorships. Native corporations in Alaska are not large Fortune 500 corporations with diverse and unlimited shareholder bases. Interlocking directorships, as they are defined by some of our board members, are actively sought and encouraged, mainly for economic gain. These kinds of directorships, with one individual serving on more than one board and possibly various other boards and commissions, in addition to working full-time, are beneficial to corporations where networking is endless and undeniably profitable. Our small corporations would certainly benefit from extensive and intricate networking. However, because we are small, native corporations with limited and fixed shareholder bases, our needs are vastly dissimilar. We are native corporations first, in which cultural and tribal priorities must be considered in addition to the business at hand. In the case of Alaska Native corporations, the moral responsibility of each director should be to the shareholders of either one or the other corporation. I often ask myself when sitting in meetings, to which corporation is this person loyal, first and foremost? Is this person taking my best interests into consideration, or is this person basing the decision on what was discussed at another meeting for another Native corporation? Few directorships are available to our people who may want to participate in the decision and policy-making processes. If we required our present board members to choose one corporation or the other, we would still have the potential to create boards with the widest range of interests and abilities. More importantly, everyone would believe they have a chance to put their ideas into action. Requiring total and complete loyalty of each member of our boards is not unreasonable. Allowing others to participate in the decision-making process of our corporations is necessary to provide for the free exchange of information and ideas not possible at this point in time. It could possibly eliminate the above problems of nepotism and conflict of interest. Interlocking directorships are not perceived by shareholders to be beneficial. They are currently viewed as positions which are jealously guarded and protected by those few who were lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. When some individuals serve on more than one board, they may be viewed by non-natives as being involved and active in their communities. On the other side of the coin, they may be viewed by natives as being power hungry and only after the money. The third issue, 1991. By 1991, some of our corporations will have fallen by the wayside and some will still be viable and solvent. Those which have fallen by the wayside will probably have lost their land also, because land is our bargaining base. If no longer solvent and in heavy debt, what do we have left to pay off those debts? Our land. And this is what started it all in the first place. The Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act was the method through which Congress and the oil companies could gain access to the oil deposits of the North Slope. Before any drilling could be done, the Aboriginal land claim suit had to be settled. Our corporations are their instruments devised by them. In order to exist, we must operate on their terms. In order to survive, we must be able to blend our knowledge of their business operations with our knowledge of our cultures and our knowledge of theirs. If not successful, the land will in the long run go back to the control of those others who gave it to us in the first place. We must not jeopardize our land. Provisions for 1991 must have the input of all shareholders. Perhaps there are people within the corporations who have the expertise required or who can do the researching and interviewing and gathering of all the data required to thoroughly consider all the issues. More informational meetings should be held on a regular basis to inform, to advise, and to allow for the free exchange of ideas and information in the public arena, providing for those children born after the deadline. This issue goes hand in glove with the above issue, in that there are some out there who are not direct beneficiaries of Native corporations in the sense that we are. How are we going to provide for them so that they will also benefit by receiving dividends and participating as shareholders and property owners? We must ensure their stake in the future of the corporations simply because our very existence beyond 1991 depends on acquiring and utilizing new shareholders, expanding our shareholder bases. We are limited to those individuals born as of December 18, 1971. By 1991, to state a basic truth, some of our shareholders will no longer be present in body. A lot of us will be advisors. We will need the generations born after December 18, 1971 to carry us into the new century, provided that we as corporations still exist. In order for them to qualify as active participants, they must be shareholders. Recommendations. Our shareholders are politically astute, whatever their generation, yet our board members summarily dismiss those who voice specific concerns that certain kinds of business relationships at our point in development are not healthy. Must we wait for the state to determine our regulations for us, or can we take the lead and set a precedent which will guide others? For example, specific recommendations pertaining to the issues highlighted above might be: 1, if a board member sees the potential for conflict of interest in terms of serving the corporation in another economic capacity, that board member should be encouraged to resign without prejudice. Participation in meetings at the board or management level introduces an unfair advantage, despite assurances to the contrary that the board member would disqualify him or herself from further discussion and negotiations. We cannot allow board members or their immediate family members to benefit economically without giving others a chance to serve. To eliminate the question of nepotism in a corporation, candidates for boards whose direct blood relatives serve the corporations at the management or board level must be encouraged to run on an independent campaign. Our corporations should not in any manner finance their campaign. Then and only then will shareholders truly feel that they are part of the process, that they will have made the choice. There is no choice when the individual is running as a management candidate. Two, we must establish limits of terms and prevent interlocking directorships on native corporations from occurring. Perhaps we could allow for overlapping of terms of a set length, but we cannot allow interlocking directorships to occur for extended periods of time. We must allow others to participate in the decision and policy-making processes. Future growth and expansion of our corporations depends on a constantly changing leadership, which educates others to the business of our corporations. Three, our highest priority should be determining the focus of our research and considering options available in terms of 1991. Are shareholders allowed to participate along the way? Are the corporations working in concert to produce and distribute information to shareholders in a timely manner? My advice is, do not wait until 1990 to begin educating shareholders. Some of us want to know now what the corporations are doing to prepare us for that deadline. For example, I need to know now what information is out there, who is gathering it, what are the issues and options being considered, how are we putting this information together, and when can I expect a report? Four, those children born after the deadline must be considered as the new corporate shareholders. We must provide for their future, our future, and their futures as carriers of the torch, the new rising stars, our future as tribal entities. Will we allow them to shine as leaders of our corporations or force them to shine outside the corporations? Concluding remarks. All of the above issues, and certainly more, must be dealt with now with all due speed and finality. We are not laying the groundwork to deal with these issues to the satisfaction of our people. We seem to be stagnating in a quagmire of issues which cost us money and threaten our existence. Our corporations are borrowing money to pay loans to other corporations with whom we are directly related. They continue to hold on to economically burgeoning acquisitions which other non-native corporations would have cut loose long ago. They support as management slate individuals who should run as independents to eliminate the questions of nepotism and conflict of interest. Some board members represent other corporations with whom we deal on an economic basis at either the management or director level. Our corporate boards are not informing us of deadlines for shareholder resolutions well enough in advance for us to prepare and submit said resolutions for consideration at the next annual meeting. They are not educating us to our responsibilities and rights as shareholders. They are not using the information meeting arena to hear what our needs and concerns are, or to solicit feedback on their concerns and needs. Our people are not so naive that they do not anticipate most potential problems. We are fortunate to have shareholders who were raised on status reports of the Alaska Native Land Claim suit or participated in the struggle in one way or another. 1991 is fast approaching, and all shareholders have a direct stake in the outcome. Shareholders have expressed various views about what they will do with their stock at that point in time. Some have stated emphatically that if the current situation of boards of directors being unresponsive to the needs and wishes of shareholders is not dealt with and changed dramatically, they will sell their stock. They see no progress at this point in time. Others have stated that they do not want to see shares leave native control. They anticipate control by others. Many shareholders refuse to participate in the open arena and the election process. They are disgusted with the current state of affairs. I must repeat what I stated previously, that interlocking directorships in native corporations have not been beneficial to shareholders. Again, a select few are benefiting politically and monetarily. The demand for a statement of loyalty is made because historically, directorships have been controlled and manipulated by the select few mentioned so often. Giving up a directorship does not mean that one's integrity is diminished or that one's power base is lost. Or does it naturally follow that giving up a directorship means one will lose all other appointments that occurred because one was a director? I am proud, as I am sure others are, When I hear that some of my people represent us on boards at the local, state, or national level. Yet, when I look to see how these individuals are spreading the fruits inevitably born of these relationships, I see very little. How many other individuals are being identified as potential representatives to boards should vacancies occur? How many of our people are gainfully employed in private enterprise or at the city, state, or national levels? How many of our people are employed in corporate holdings at the management level? How much more money do we have coming into our villages and cities to provide programs and services to our people? If these interlocking directorships were in fact beneficial, we as a people would benefit. Are we successful thus far? With my limited participation in various public arenas, I would say that our boards are excelling in certain areas but are failing in others. Certainly, we do not require complicated explanations of all meetings and transactions. We do, however, require honesty, respect, and timely information on matters which will have significant impact on our business. Informational meetings should be learning experiences for both shareholders and board members. Access to board members is ensured and participation is guaranteed. We cannot afford to alienate our shareholders. They are our connection to reality. They are our connection to the past, the present, and the future. Their views on all matters from where to hold meetings to conflict of interest to selling and syndication of buildings to cutting loose of white elephants are valid and deserve candid and honest responses. The success of any corporation, family, public, or native, is dependent on the constant and active participation of its shareholders. If a greater number of shareholders participate at all levels, then the corporation does not stagnate. In general, shareholders develop a sense of ownership, which inevitably heightens activity. We must ensure and be assured that the integrity of our corporations is preserved. Our job as shareholders is not only to wait patiently for our annual report and hope for a dividend which will provide a treat for us or our families. Our responsibility as shareholders is to attend as many meetings as possible, to ask pertinent questions, and to be informed. We must participate in the election process. We must be advocates for our people, the old and young alike. We must provide the necessary connections between the old and the young, the cities and the villages, the leaders and their people. All of the above is difficult when our leaders maintain as little contact as possible with shareholders. All of the above boils down to our children and their children, our future. The generations born after us do not deserve to read about the Nixon era Great Society program, also known as the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act in the history books. Alaska's peoples are proud peoples with rich cultural backgrounds. We are trying to make a non-native organism work by combining our knowledge of the best of our cultures with what we perceive as the best of theirs. How many of us are getting lost along the way? The most difficult, almost impossible accomplishment will be to end 1991 with our heads facing the right direction, with the pride in knowing that we accomplished the impossible. We beat them at their game using their game board. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brandel. Thank you.
My name is Tony Strong. I'm from Tlaquan. I currently live here in Juneau. I don't have a lot of written comments or anything that I wanted to make, but I've been looking at the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act for some time and trying to determine what problems do I have with it, what problems do other people have with it, and what solutions can we suggest to those problems. There are, of course, several problems that people have identified tonight, and I certainly agree with a lot of them and agree with the frustrations that they've expressed. I have some suggestions, perhaps, that might be useful for people to start considering. I kind of like the suggestions only because I guess just because I'm egocentric. One problem that Leona Florendo talked about, and several other people talked about, was what happens to those people who were born after December 18, 1971? How come they're not shareholders, and how come they're not direct beneficiaries of the Claims Settlement Act? And how do we accommodate them? Well, a suggestion I have I'll first make the suggestion in short form and then explain it. My suggestion is that the stock of the corporation can be held as a life estate with the right of what they call an inter vivos transfers only to the corporation at fair market value. Now, that's a lot of lawyers' lingo and not very useful to people, but
some Latin thrown in too.
Yeah. The idea I have with that is a life estate means that the person who is a native owns it only during their lifetime. When they die, the stock goes directly back to the corporation. All people who are born native or a percentage of native, whoever the politicians decide should be determined to be a native, would get to be a shareholder, regardless of when they were born. So people born on December 19, 1971 would be a shareholder. People born tomorrow would be a shareholder. All the time, every time somebody died, the corporation takes back the stock. So in a sense, they own that only during their lifetime. That solves a couple of problems. One of them is that ownership of that corporation stays in the native hands, and that's perpetual. It also deals with the problem of those people who are born after December 18, 1971. The problem of land loss exists now. As some people have pointed out, land can be alienated now. It's not restrict, the act does not restrict the sale of land. My suggestion in trying to deal with that problem, and a lot of people are not, the issue of native governments here in Alaska is starting to become a lot more discussed. It's becoming a lot more discussed in the state as a whole. Some communities have had native governments for quite some time, have never gone away from a native government and set up a municipality under state law. Some of them have several different kinds of governing bodies within one community. Well, my suggestion concerning land deals with the land in two respects. One is that the native governments need to have land in which to govern over, and two, the native corporations need to have a right to be able to access that land to develop. Without land as an asset, the native corporations lose a lot of their value. I say that it's possible for both those problems to be solved by having the native governments hold title to the land and the native corporations hold an exclusive right of development. That means that the native corporations would be the ones determining how the land would be developed. Certainly how they'd work it out politically with the village corporation or village government would be something that they would work out politically between themselves. I don't think that land should ever be taxable by the state or the local government. I mean municipalities. Local government under the state definition. Local government, as I see it, by the native government, sure. Native governments, in my view, do have a right to tax. That right to tax has never been taken away by the Claims Settlement Act or any previous enactments by Congress. There's another difficulty that was talked about tonight, and of course it's talked about throughout the state in a lot of different places that I've been to. One is, who is going to govern the corporations? The problem of, Leona again talked about, the problem of conflicts of interests or things of that nature that come up consistently throughout the state. One of the problems I see that is a result of is the fact that the corporate structure is not a traditional native structure of government. If we look at, certainly in Tlingit society, the method of governance historically has been through the clan leaders. The clan leaders were charged with taking care of their clan members. If they were not taking care of their clan members, the clan members would remove them as their clan leader. Well, how do you address that today? I'm not sure. But what I'm saying, but my, the problem I have with corporate government, certainly at the village level, at Sea Alaska level or regional level, it might be different. But on the village level, the corporate structure is a foreign structure, and what it does is superimposes a popularly elected body onto a community that historically had been governed by clan members, by clan leaders. And when you change the structure of government, or you change the structure of decision-making in a community, to me that leads to confusion. It leads to not knowing what to expect out of that decision-making body. When you don't know what to expect from them, it can only lead, in my view, to higher levels of anxiety, dissatisfaction. With those higher levels of anxiety come higher levels of, as it's called under sociology, social dysfunction, meaning a lot more alcoholism, a lot more interfamily fights, things of that nature. And I'm really bothered by these foreign structures, foreign to the smaller communities, the people who have liked to maintain their tradition. What I'm saying is that rather than, and my direct recommendation is that rather than having a superimposed mandated structure for governing the local village councils and for governing the village corporations, is to recognize that there needs to be flexibility, that a given community should be able to organize their corporation in a fashion that they're comfortable with, so that when they elect their leaders, or however they're appointed, whether it be they're elected by being clan leaders, or is it because they're elected by popular vote, the community can know more what to expect out of those people who are being elected. That brings me to the last specific recommendation. This deals with native governments. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act does not address native governments in the state. It really remains silent on that issue. That's my personal opinion. I've read through it a few times looking for specific sections on it that discussed native government. That means it discussed at least three different aspects of native government, or any government for that matter. One is, and it's called jurisdiction. I think for government you have to have the authority to govern people. In other words, it's personal jurisdiction. Another is subject matter jurisdiction. What kinds of things can you legislate in local government? And a third, of course, is territorial jurisdiction. Over what land can you govern? Well, my view is that native governments ought to have some kind of land base in which they can govern. That helps determine when you have a territorial or some defined boundaries. You can exercise territorial jurisdiction. The other two aspects of jurisdiction really are left up to the native government themselves. How much, what subject matter do they want to govern over? And again, what people do they want to govern over? The problem of personal jurisdiction has been heavily legislated by the United States Congress. There's been several acts that have been passed that limit and in some ways what native governments can govern over. My comments I have certainly need a lot more further explanation, and I don't expect that what my thoughts are complete at this time enough. My hope is that other people in the audience might have some questions that I've raised at least raised in their mind if they have any questions they want to ask me, or if yourself want to have some questions they want to ask me, so I can further explain some of the confusion I've raised by my suggestion. If not, I'm done.
Could I just ask you one question, Mr. Strong? The idea that the shares should be held as a life estate, and when they die, they go back to the corporation, and all Native persons, including those born since 1971, would be entitled to be enrolled as shareholders. I hope this isn't an unfair question, but how do we get from, assuming that's an idea that people support, how do we get from here to there?
That's a good question. I think one of the difficulties, I addressed it a little bit by the thought of inter vivos transfer and didn't explain that. I'm glad you asked the question on it. One of the biggest problems I see in reaching that point is those people who want to sell. And I think that does present some problem, is there are some people who want to sell their stock. And to take away that right is taking away, in some sense, taking away what they would view as a property right, or a right that they have that may be vested. They've already got that right, and they don't want that right taken away from them. That, I figured, could be addressed by allowing the individual to sell their stock at fair market value to the Congress, the United States Congress has been, at least we've been told as American public, that the United States Congress has what they call plenary authority over Indian affairs, Native affairs in America. That means absolute authority. They could do whatever they wanted. They could take away all the rights we have and not have to compensate us one bit for it. Well, politically, that wouldn't be acceptable. To me, Congress just has to modify the Claim Settlement Act and saying, instead of 1991 stock going out, becoming alienable, say, amend the act, the specific sections of the act, and say it is now, as we've just discussed. My personal feeling is that the more that is explained and discussed in the Native community, it becomes a viable option, a viable alternative to stock alienation in 1991. I think it's a saleable idea politically.
Let me ask you one other question. If the people who wanted to sell their shares are then paid out at fair market value, then they cease to be
shareholders,
and you will have converted the corporation from a shareholders corporation into a perpetual membership corporation, mm-hmm. in which every person in the tribe participates, mm-hmm. and becomes a member just by being born into the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the children of the shareholder who sells his shares? Would you agree that,
the children of this person who sells their shares automatically, by virtue of being born, become a shareholder?
Yes, Mrs. Danhar.
That's fair.
Just a sec. Did you get that question on the?
What?
No.
I could. I could.
Yes, sir.
Fair market value of stock today and from here on. Even if I may risk losing my children to be non-American, and decide that I'm disgusted with the board of directors. after, what is the fair market value of my stocks as 100% shareholder?
I think that's a pretty fair question, and it's a very difficult one to answer. How do you come to determine the fair market value of something that's not on the market? And it's a difficult question to try to answer shareholders now. I agree. There is no number. There's no magic number that determines. I mean, I did work for Sea Alaska Corporation in the shareholder relations department and went to a lot of shareholder meetings where that question was asked repeatedly. And unfortunately, there is no easy answer to that. We could talk about shareholders' equity in the corporation. In other words, you divide the number of shareholders into how many dollars the corporation is worth, and you come up with shareholders' equity. I mean, that's really a gross way of stating it. But that doesn't tell you how much somebody else in the marketplace is willing to pay you for your stock. I mean, if you talk about transfers of stock in the stock market in lower Manhattan, the value of a sale of stock down there may far exceed the shareholders' equity in the corporation. So that's fair market value. Unfortunately, Nora, I don't have an easy answer for that one.
Yes, sir.
Given now, I'm paraphrasing it. But what you're saying is, see if I understand this correctly. If you had to liquidate your stock, our stock today would actually depend on the market that's in existence as far as land and timber and other minerals and other assets that you're holding today. I think that's what you're referring to. I think it's so easy to say that. Am I correct or am I wrong?
That's in determining shareholders' equity. That I believe you've stated it correctly. But in determining the answer to Nora's question, though, is what is fair market value? That is a different question than
okay,
that.
Maybe then I may pose a question, if I may. Are you finished, or can I? It's a similar question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, if we're in a rough ballpark figure today, and when we're in a rough ballpark figure, as far as the stock is concerned, I, as a shareholder, today, if we had to liquidate and we wanted to sell today, what would that stock be worth?
That would probably fluctuate by the hour. If you look at the way the New York Stock Exchange works, in the morning a sale of stock could be going for $25, for example, go for $25, but so many people are trying to buy it that it shot up to $100 by the end of the day. That could determine by the end of the day on today that the fair market value for your stock is $100, where in the morning it was $25. That still wouldn't, I mean, it's a different question than what shareholders' equity is, though. It really depends on the demand, in other words, the demand for the item.
I was just going to say that if you, I think that you're all interested in asking Tony Strong some more questions, but if you like, we could take a 5-minute break and have some coffee and then come back and keep grilling Mr. Strong. We'll just take a 5-minute break.
I think he likes it.
So far. I think... Some others had questions for Tony, if they're, Mr. Ward.
I don't know whether it's for Tony or for the crowd or whatever, but he asked a question. There's, within my corporation, I'm in a village and a regional corporation. I've served on the board of both of those. I've opposed the board of both of those. I oppose the idea of being able to use shareholders' money to control the corporation. Going on in most cases, whether intentional or not intentional, that is reality. But my major concern is that everybody in this room has a relative that has died for one reason or another. We've all died. We're worried about the children. But now, what do we do with my mother if she doesn't particularly, my mother, my aunt,
but they want to have their own home. They don't want to live in an apartment. They don't want to live on welfare. They don't want to be beholden to the state of Alaska, this federal government. They want to stand tall and they want to be proud of what they are. They don't want to be underneath the thumb of a federal handout program or a state handout program. Now, what do we say to those people that are already dead? They died in the last 13 years. They're going to die in the next 8 years. When do we start giving them a little piece of seed money, a little piece of ground, a little home, and a job? When do they get what they should ought to have just because of the fact that they are Alaska Native and they own 100 shares, and we're worried an awful lot about how we're going to keep this thing going in 1991? What about the people that are dying right now? What about all of our elders that have passed on already and all of them that are going to pass on? What's the answer to that? Nobody's talking about the elders. I mean, I care about my kids. I've got 3 daughters. I care an awful lot. But I also care about my Uncle George. I also care about my Uncle Roy, who died 2 years ago. Now, he don't get nothing, not diddly out of this thing. And he died on welfare. What's the answer? We haven't waited long enough. I'm tired of waiting. And I'm young enough to wait. I'm 35. My kids can wait. We can wait forever. We can even go to work at McDonald's. But what about my uncle? What about my aunts? Simple answer would probably be nice.
I have a couple of responses. I understand most of that question was for the audience and not
That's
for
right.
me. Yeah. And the second part of the, I do have one of my answers here, one of my suggestions of dealing with where the land would be owned could in part answer that question. If the land was held, in other words, we're talking about people, elderly people in the Native community, regardless whether they're elderly or kids, if the land is owned by the Native government, seems to me would be up to the Native government then to allow them a piece of land that they would have for the rest of their life. They would build their home on it. Where they get the money to build a home, you know, this act doesn't seem to address that. I don't know that perhaps that ought to be and should have been included in an originally. Everybody get a home out of it. I don't know. But certainly, it's very difficult to talk about owning a home when you don't have any land to put it on. But if the Native governments own the land, then there's no question, or certainly less question, of how do you give some shareholders land and not others? Because right now, corporations are required to open up the land to all shareholders. There are a couple of corporations who have done that. One of them, I think two of them here in Southeast Alaska. One is Yaktat-Quan is thinking about that solution, or thinking about a solution in that area. Shawnseet Corporation down in Craig has set out a land distribution program for its shareholders. It's a fairly complicated device that took them a couple of years to develop. But what they're facing is that to give any land to any shareholder, they've got to make that land available to all shareholders. Well, you know, it presents some difficult legal problems. Those legal problems become a lot more simplified if the Native governments own that land, and anybody who wants to live in the Native government's land just ask permission of the Native government and say it's like if they would come into anybody who owns the land in private ownership. Hey, I'd like to use a piece of your land to build my house on. Can I use it for the rest of my life? That's a fairly common thing that's often done in, as I called it, a life estate. It's held during your lifetime.
The lady back here that asked about the frustrating question, you know, and it hasn't been answered, but what am I here for? What she's really saying is, you know, what about me right now today? What about me, my husband, my children today? I would like to be able to go to the grocery store and buy 2 bags of groceries instead of taking up and getting a quarter of a bag. Now, the reality is in 1991, and just respond to this, in 1991, what's going to happen is, whether it's Chase Manhattan Bank or Hunt Brothers or whatever it is, there's going to be an attempt to take over these corporations. Now, when they go to take over them, they're going to have to take over the board of directors only, which in most cases is only 12 attorneys who run the board of directors at least have a great deal of influence over them. That's the basics of what it is, because they will have a right to merger and joint venture at that time. Mm-hmm. Now, in order to spread the base out, I personally, since I am not on the board of regional corporation any longer and I don't intend to be on one, but I would feel a lot more secure knowing that regardless of what happens, that a portion of that land, which is allocated to me, whether it's identified or not by lottery or any other means, but a portion of that land would not be able to be sold, encumbered, joint ventured, marketed, done away with whatsoever in any way, fashion, or form without my signature. That we're talking about a 320-acre reserve, man, woman, child, last native land claims. Now, I realize that this is a very capitalist type of attitude, but I kind of think of it this way. In 1991, when they come to steal the land, instead of having to come from one attorney and steal it, I'd rather them have to come to all the last Canadians and steal it individually.
Again, who owns the land is a question, a difficult question. One of the problems I see in using, having the land owned by the corporations and then transferred over to the individual shareholders for ownership is that land can then be alienated from the individual ownership. If the individual owns it, if I own the piece of land and I become, I reach dire straits where I need to have some money to pay some bills, or even if I'm not able to meet payments on something that I have and I've used the land as collateral, it can be taken from me. So the land could go out of native ownership. But if I'm... Right, but if the land is held by the native governments, the corporation would not be able to encumber it. If it's owned by the native governments, as I say, not, the corporation would not be able to encumber it. It would be owned by the native government and with a right to use it during the lifetime of an individual who has a house on it. I hope I'd live more than 55 more years. Right, well, that's...
There are tricky ways to get around the law. There's 55-year leases with options for 55 more, which will flat-kill everybody in this room in 1 year.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, this needs to be addressed.
Ma'am?
I'd like to ask Mr. Strong if he sees any movement at all in any of the 12 Alaskan corporations to put any native land in a non-taxable status of some sort. I saw the other day where Galena had put some in the Alaska Land Bank, but there are a lot of administrative type problems with putting that land in the land bank where it has not set up the mechanism for putting lands in non-taxable status, nor has the commissioner given any for this, nor have the subsistence rights of those non-taxable lands been adhered to, as Anelka said the land bank would do prior to any lands being put in non-taxable status. So we basically sort of know that that land bank really isn't working yet. But do you see any movement at all amongst the native corporations to work with the federal government or with the state government to put native ancestral lands in some sort of non-taxable status?
Of the 12 regional corporations, I know of none of them that are doing that. I've heard of some village corporations who are attempting to do that by transferring it over to the IRA council or to the traditional government. But I know of no regional corporation who's done that. As far as the land bank, I think there was at least one village corporation that has used the land bank as a way of holding the land and at the same time getting some additional capital.
How would they do that?
What?
How would they, by putting money in the land bank, get additional capital?
I'm not that familiar with that. I think there's some people in the audience who are more familiar with that and watched and met, perhaps even helped bring that about.
Can you think of an mechanism for elders to get land and arm?
The problem under current law, as I understand current law, is that if you create classes of shareholders, you're subjecting the corporation to a shareholder derivative suit, which would say that, in other words, anybody who was born on December 18, 1971, is not an elder, could sue the corporation for treating another group of shareholders more favorably than themselves, and they would win the suit.
I've got no problem with it. It seems like we've utilized that very, very method to allow the entire generation to pass away without receiving the true benefit.
I agree. You're right, and there's no easy solution that I can think of right off the top of my head of how to benefit the people who preceded us and brought us to where we're at. I can't think of an easy solution to that beyond what I've perhaps stated here in terms of land, being able to use land, things of that nature.
It's one thing I was wondering about. In the Otner region, I came across a situation talking to people up there where one man, his mother died, brother died, cousins died, and he inherited all their shares. He himself has no children to pass them on to. And also in the same region, I came across cases where the inheritor of shares was a non-native person. So what I'm wondering is, in the type of corporation where you have not shareholders, but a membership corporation, if the man who has inherited all these shares doesn't want to sell his shares, but he doesn't want to, but he feels that he's being treated unfairly by giving him, we'll say right now, if you have a $100 dividend, he's actually going to get much more because they estimated that he has about 2,000 shares. So how would situation like that could that be dealt with? And also, how could a situation where you already have today non-native shareholders through inheritance, how could those be?
The problem of minority representation on any governing body is something that can't, I have no solution to minority representation. And that's, I got from your first question, I got the sense that that's what you're asking. The answer to the second question of what do you do about non-natives who are holding shares now, I think they have a property right which you can't take away from them. It's a very difficult thing to take away from them. But if you convert what they're holding, and this is a difficult concept to be consistent with, but convert what they're holding into a life estate, then after they die, they won't be able to pass it on to additional non-natives. Or give them the option of selling it back to the corporation. That option of selling it to the corporation exists now, I mean, in terms of 1991. As a matter of fact, as I understand, ANILCA, the stock, anybody who wants to sell their shares as of 1991, according to present law, does have an obligation to make it available to the corporation first.
Yes. Yes, sir. The Claims Settlement Act doesn't address
the issue of sovereignty. The corporation is like any other corporation in Law 48 with some modification in it. So the corporation is not a governing body and therefore is not sovereign in terms of a government. Amos, I agree with you, and I did suggest a solution which I'd be glad to talk with you about again. The solution I suggested was that anybody who is born becomes a shareholder, and they are a shareholder during their lifetime. When they die, the corporation gets the stock back.
Theory is correct, so the government can get out of giving us services.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that this is a suggestion to the government. I addressed that a little bit initially when I started saying is to me that's up to people who are going to testify on what percentage a person is as an Indian. It's real difficult for me to define what an Indian is because I know some full bloods who disclaim ever being a native and don't want to be associated with being a native. And for all purposes to me, they're not natives. And I know some people who are 1/16th native or non-natives who have completely adopted a native way of life. And it's hard for me to say to them, you're not a native, when everything they do and think, and they may have been adopted by a native family, and they're 100% non-native biologically, it's hard for me to say to them, you're not a native. It's an emotional issue. And it's an emotional issue that, to me, it's gonna take politicians to answer that question.
Mrs. Denhar.
I'm not sure if General Motors or Ford Company or Exxon ever asks the question, are you full white, are you full Italian, or any of those things? And I'm not sure if they're subsidized by the government, like we are. Maybe they borrow money.
Good political question to ask him, and I agree. Yeah, I agree with you. We should determine ourselves whether we're native or not, and it shouldn't be left up to others.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Part 25 in the Indian session, there was a definition of what they term as native and Indian. Same thing is also stated in the
You know, that just a little bit of history here. I've I'm familiar with. The question of one-quarter blood or more came up in a 1913 appropriation to the Cherokee Indians in Oklahoma, and it was an educational appropriation. That was the very first time percentage of blood was ever discussed in any federal legislation. The very next time you saw it was in 1934 in the Johnson O'Malley provisions of the Indian Reorganization Act. That was where they started putting very clearly in state and federal legislation the issue of whether or not a person was native determined by federal legislation, quarter blood or more. Again, that was the federal government making that decision. It wasn't tribes. The Cherokee Nation says that anybody who's a descendant of a Cherokee is a member of the tribe. So anybody who's even 1/334th Cherokee is a Cherokee by their standards, and causes some political problem between tribes in the lower 48, but then that's their problem. I don't advocate federal supervision over our lands. I maybe didn't make that clear before. I don't like the fact that the federal government holds tribal lands in trust, not in the definition of trust that they use. I don't like the federal government telling me how I'm going to use my land or whether or not I can use it, or having me ask permission of them, or even telling me where I should live as a native. I mean, if we're going to have any kind of trust relationship with the federal government, I ought to be determining what that trust relationship ought to be instead of the federal government determining it. And that, you know, that's my position. It's a political position, and I advocate it. There's no reason for me that I see that says to me that we can't have a relationship with the federal government that says they have an obligation to protect us in ways that we want to be protected, not how they determine themselves how we should be protected. I'm not familiar with Gold Belt. I'm not even a shareholder of Gold Belt.
Mr. Ward?
Denominator that all the regions, villages, and groups have is the profits from 7-9 taking away the various cute mechanisms that everybody uses to come to that. Is that a vehicle to create the tribal entity with the profits of 7-9? Because we have that in legislation now. It's the only thing that is a common